Christmas time in America is practically the most insane time of the year. People are running around like mad people, trying to buy this and buy that at the last minute. Buying and selling is going on at a hysterical rate. And basically people are losing their minds, trying to figure out what to get for others and trying to figure out what to do. And everybody is in complete stress. How will I accomplish this? How will I accomplish that? There's no time left. We have to rush and do and run. And it's interesting also that the thieves at the same time are thinking, when everybody goes away to their other friends on Christmas Eve and Christmas, we'll come in too and steal everything. So you have a whole network of people whose interests are intertwined to buy, sell, take, give. It's incredible. It's basically impossible to find a peaceful situation at this time of the year. Now, what is even more interesting, at least to me, is that during the days of the actual holiday itself, everything is incredibly peaceful. Now, I know in Russia, due to the difference of the Orthodox Church and the Standard Church in the West, you will have different days, so you can just change this to your own set of holidays. So you will find that when the actual holiday comes, which for us here is tomorrow and Monday and then the days after up to New Year's, everything becomes very peaceful and people start to blossom and bloom in a good spirit. Yesterday, it was basically the most insane day of the year, and today is going to be even worse. But then, all of a sudden, it just goes, and everybody becomes peaceful. Now, what are they becoming peaceful about? Are they becoming peaceful because of the actual holiday? Or are they becoming peaceful because all of the stress of preparing for the holiday is over? Now, if we're becoming very peaceful because now we have no reason to be stressed, that's a very interesting phenomenon. It's very similar to that famous example of somebody bashing their head against the wall. When somebody asks them, why are you doing that? They say, because it feels so good when I stop. So we have a situation where we're putting ourselves in such enormous stress, and then we feel so good when it's over. Now, various churches are having enormous festivals on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and probably in Lincoln Center, the famous cultural center in New York, there's going to be the Messiah, or maybe it was in the University of Boston last year. I don't remember. It's broadcast on the radio. I used to sing that when I was in high school, and I just loved the singing of it. It's such a glorious thing, especially when you get to the final part of it. It's just so fabulous. Certain TV stations just have a fireplace with logs burning fire. That's all they have. And they play Christmas music along with it. People share gifts with each other, and they hug each other, and they see family that they haven't seen in a long time. Even our house this week coming up is going to be filled with people non-stop. It's going to be packed with people. And on Friday night, there'll be a huge party here with all various people from the local community and everything that we know for so many years. And then it'll go really late. And then Saturday morning, I'm going to broadcast. So it's a time of the year that you see people you haven't seen in a long time, family you haven't seen in a long time. It's like a get-together. Everybody feels that spirit of get-together. Now let's analyze for a second what actually is happening at this time of the year. Now if you analyze it from the spiritual point of view, what is the point of this particular holiday? We have a church up the street. Actually, in our neighborhood here, we have churches all around us. It's just everywhere churches in this area. But the church up this street has a sign that says, Christ is the reason for the season. It works better in English. It rhymes. And So then I'm thinking about it and I'm saying, yeah, okay, but really, what are we celebrating? Okay, so we're celebrating the birth of Christ. Fair enough. But why on this day? Now, what's interesting about that question is that actually Christ wasn't born on December 25th or whatever it is in Russia. He was born sometime in March, they think. And this day was shifted to the December 25th arbitrarily because there was some economic reason or some political reason for it to be done so when it happened. Now, it has become such a tradition that nobody questions that is this the day that Christ was actually born? Now, my birthday is in October, so if you shifted it over to August because it was easier for you, and you were celebrating my birthday in August, now what would that mean to me? Now, for me, it wouldn't mean anything. You're having my birthday party in August. And I'm going, okay, yeah, right, sure. We're having a party, but it has no relationship to me. But if you all believed it was my birthday, if you all agreed it was my birthday, then you would have a very good time at my birthday party. Now, whether or not I liked my birthday party or not could be practically insignificant, irrelevant. And if in my birthday party in August, you gave each other presents, but you didn't give any to me, I would think, gee, that's awful strange. I never thought of that before, but it's really hysterical when you think about it. You have a birthday party for me, you're giving each other presents, you're having a great time together, and I'm just like, you know, well, I'm here too, gang. It's actually very funny. But somehow or another, it doesn't really matter. Now, I'm going to put aside all of the commercial reasons why it doesn't matter, because that's not really important. That's not the subject of this discussion. Because we all know that it's very important for the economy of every country to have a big sales thing in December. I don't know about the huge chains, but I know most regular stores make more money in December than they do throughout the whole rest of the year. So economically, December, this day, Christmas, is essential for the whole economy of all people. But everybody talks about that, so that's not very important. That's nothing significant. What I find to be more significant is how everybody creates Christmas. Everybody has agreed to believe that this is the birthday of Christ and it has some significance. Now, it doesn't matter whether there really is that significance or not, and it doesn't matter why. It doesn't matter that people do it for economic reasons. It doesn't matter that people do it for family reasons. And it doesn't matter what reason whatsoever. The significant point is that everybody agrees to make this a significant day. It doesn't matter what religion you are, because everybody benefits somehow or another. Now, that is a very significant thing, if you think about it. We have, as a group of people, accepted, for whatever reason, this day has significance. We might be accepting this because of our religion, where we accept some kind of a calendar, which everybody accepts. Or we might be accepting this because our family accepted it and it's a historical tradition. But for whatever reason, we've accepted it. And we've all agreed to accept the same thing. We're all focused on the same thing. And whether or not the purported, that's a better word, main personality of this is part of the day or not, doesn't really matter. To certain persons who are very religious, it may matter a lot. To a merchant, it may not matter at all. To somebody who doesn't even know or care, it doesn't matter. But none of this matters. Because everybody has agreed on one point. This is an important day, and that day signifies certain things. And we all accept those things, we all agree with those things, and we feel good about it. Okay, we may not feel good with all the shopping and all of the arranging and all of the cleaning and whatever, but the reason we're doing it is because we do feel real good about that day. For some parents, this day signifies the only time of the year that their whole family is in one place. And this is really significant. For some, it means the only time of the year where all their friends are in the same place at the same time. So you get the point. But the mechanism of that is very important for us to understand, because when you understand it, you understand an awful lot about community. The power of group unification on a particular thing. Here we have a day which is just a plain old ordinary day in the cosmic scheme of things. It's not Christ's birthday, and it has really very little significance in the astronomical, astrological, or spiritual scheme of things. But we've all agreed to accept it as the most significant day of the year. And this whole country of the United States, where I happen to be right now, temporarily, is shaking like this because of that one arbitrary day. Even my cat came in yesterday just saying, "What is going on here?" Hiding behind my chair saying, "Help me, it's just crazy out there." So this day has become what it has become because we made it that way. We decided we're going to empower this day. Now, that's pretty amazing. All of us as a people all over the world have empowered a day. That means we got power. We have the power to create days. We have the power to create energy. We have the power to create anything we want, basically. We have the power to make the most significant things in the world happen. Now, the interesting thing about Christmas is that it's some very distant, separated event from us. In other words, we don't mind sharing gifts with each other on somebody else's birthday. We don't really have a connection to it. But because it has significance in ways we explained before, we just embrace it. Now, we can do that in any day. Any day we want, we can do the same thing. We can put our power into it. We can put our energy into it. Whatever we want, when we as a group empower that thing, we give it great power. We do that about various religious ideas, various religious icons, various religious personalities. People do it because of political reasons or philosophical reasons. What is causing people to strap explosives to their bodies and blow themselves up? That kind of incredible dedication to a goal which they really believe in and which many believe in empowers such ideas. And we may not understand how that is happening, but in their community, where they have empowered this ideal, it becomes not only thinkable, it becomes an act of devotion. Now, this is a very, very interesting concept, how we can empower things which may be completely contrary to what we are, or completely contrary to what we feel in our normal state of being. We can bring ourselves to a state which is quite contradictory to our natural state of being. And we can share that state with millions of people around us. How we deal with belief and how we deal with what we choose to empower is an essential part of any community. This brings up the issue of vision. It's one of the most essential issues in any endeavor. Vision. Vision. Vision is the cornerstone, the keystone of all endeavor. It is, you know what a keystone is? It's that one stone that holds together everything. Now, vision is that which gives us meaning in all respects. There are many management gurus, those people who help companies and corporations or even communities to develop what they're doing in the best way possible. And they always speak about vision as the primary ingredient. This vision is something which is so essential, so important to them, because it's what gives all direction. And when we speak about direction, we are speaking about that which makes things real, that which makes things develop, that which makes things grow. For example, if you have a company, you must have a vision. What it is you're trying to be, what it is that you wish it to be, that greatest possible scenario of what you're doing. Then the next step is that everybody should share that vision. So it seems that this vision or understanding that which we wish it to be and having others agree with it is what gives power. When people share the same vision, then they work towards the same thing. They're developing things with the same ideal. Vision is different from goals. Goals are what you're trying to accomplish, like to make this or do that or create this. But a vision is that scene of the accomplishment in general, of the essence of what you are. Let's say, for example, you have a goal in your company to sell a lot of gas. But you have a vision to be an important part of your society by giving good services which are helping people. Now, let's say you have people in your company who don't share your vision, but do share your goal. So they understand goal is to sell gas. So if I have to cheat these people to get them to buy gas, or I have to do something which is, you know, really a harmful thing, but it sells more gas, this is good. Because after all, selling gas is the goal. Yet another person who shares the vision of being offering services and assisting people with this facility will look at selling gas in a different way. They will see selling gas is good, but not at the cost of destroying the vision by cheating people or harming people in the process. With this example, you can understand how vision is a very broad understanding of something, and goals or accomplishments are very narrow. And the reason why that people should share the same vision is because it gives them more freedom. It gives the whole organization greater possibility of growth. Take, for example, that person who was just selling gas and didn't care how he did it. Higher management has to waste time, waste energy, waste money to come down and tell him, wait, you can't do that. First, they have to find out about it, and they have to adjust him. This is a big endeavor. And that person may not understand why this is happening, because after all, the goal is to sell gas. Because there's this conflict between the two, there's a friction, and friction means loss of energy. And it usually just creates heat. Things are not flowing smoothly. Vision is so important, because when you have that vision, you can make decisions on your own without wasting time of other people having to correct you. You don't have to waste time with having somebody to tell you what to do, because when you share the same vision, you fit immediately into what should be done. Just imagine a big kitchen filled with people who are all working to create a big feast. And if somebody has to go around and tell each and every person what to do all the time and correct them and negotiate between them when they bump into each other, it's a big work. But when everybody shares the same vision of what has to be done and how it has to be done, they can see amongst themselves how to adjust their activities to accomplish the same vision. It's kind of like when you have a couple of artists working on the same painting. Actually, this is a very good example. In the BBT, we used to, when we were in a big hurry to paint a lot of paintings, have maybe sometimes 4 or 5 different artists working on the same painting. And if you know anything about artists, you will know that that's the most difficult thing in the world, that they all work on the same painting. Because when they all work on the same painting, everybody has an idea what to do. But because they agreed on the drawing before, they planned out what they wanted to accomplish, it was easier. And because they understood, each of them understood what it was they should do according to their own capacities, they could share much easier. For example, somebody was good at backdrops, somebody was good at jewelry, somebody was good at hands, somebody was good at color. And because these people were good at their particular things, and everybody accepted it, they agreed upon it, because they were painting the same painting, the same picture, it worked real well. You didn't need somebody to come in and say, now you do this, now you do that, all the time. They just automatically did it because they saw the picture, they saw how they fit in, and they saw how to make it work. This is much more organic, very organic, because it allows people to participate in creating a vision without as much friction. And when this happens, it makes things work real well. There are certain points in this discussion which I think are valuable for us as spiritualists. And the reason it's valuable for us as spiritualists, because we can do things with this understanding which will help us very much. It will help us because it will give us a hint or give us a solution to how we can, as a group of people, accomplish wonderful things in a very, very nice way. For example, what we do here on our Saturdays, what we do in our forums, or what we do in our web presentation, we all have basically the same vision. Back to the painting of the picture. When everybody agrees on the same picture, and we're all painting the same picture, we have a lot more freedom to act on our own. We all know what has to be done. We all know how it has to be done. We all know when it has to be done. So we just kind of on our own adjust for other people when we're doing things. You get the point that we've created Christmas because of our vision. We can create a working business because of our vision. We can create a wonderful feast production because of our vision. We can create a great temple because of our vision. A temple. When we share the same vision, in whatever endeavors we are doing, that vision will give us the template by which we can accomplish all kinds of things. Even a family must have a vision. If the family has the same vision, then everything works very fast, very rapidly, and without much friction. Actually, the elements of running a family, the elements of running a business, the elements of running a country are very similar. These elements include a continuous updating of how to paint the picture. Let's say the person next to you is painting and their brush breaks. You have a brush, you just hand it to them. If you run out of paint, somebody gets more paint.
I mean, to have a proper vision, one have to have a proper knowledge I mean in general. This means that if one have a real knowledge about the reality, then he can have a real vision and real goals. This is for me it is a main point to have a proper vision, you know, like in the sects, like I said, they believe that there are certain things are in certain way, you know, and it means that that they can make a vision. But if people don't have any knowledge, how they can make a proper vision? I mean in general vision, not the local vision for local goals. For example, for companies or for some, but for spiritual community or spiritual...
This is a very good question. And actually, it's the reason there are management gurus in the world. Because what they require is that people should understand, first of all, this point of sharing vision. But then the next question would be, well, what is the vision that we share? And I think that's the main problem that everybody faces in the world, discovering the vision. Whenever there have been disturbances amongst people, I feel that the main thing is that they don't know what their vision is, and therefore they're arguing about not so important things. And when they have this disagreement on what is the vision, they can't move forward. And the real solution is to sit down together and either understand what their vision is, or to modify their vision and create a new one that encompasses all of them. Because when the vision doesn't encompass all of them, what happens is that it's not part of a sharing. It's not part of sharing between them. Therefore, the first thing that everybody has to do is to learn how to sit together. And before they begin an endeavor, or periodically in an endeavor, talk about the vision. And if and when that vision starts to no longer be relevant to everybody, sit down and either modify it or figure out what's wrong. Because without that unanimity of vision, there can be no progress. Now, somebody may say that doesn't always work because there are, for example, in a religious organization, they may all be in the same organization, but they may have very different understandings of what the vision is. Now, this becomes very interesting because what do you do at this point? Do you then dictate what the vision is? Or do you say, the vision was given to us, and it is this? Or does one say that, well, we'll all sit together and create the vision? But if you do that, then you're not following something. You're creating something. So here we see a fundamental problem that religious people face. It's either they're following something that's already there, and that's their vision to follow, or they have to create something new, and then they all get together and figure it out. And even if they do get together and figure it out, usually there's somebody who can give some guidance or who can give some overriding principles within which everybody can find a unanimity. And it seems to me that this point, more than any other, is a wonderful proof, if you could use that word, in a personal God. Because when there is this personal God, then what you have is you've got this person who's giving the guidance or the framework within which that vision can manifest. You've also got that within a large corporation. Let's say, for example, Microsoft. You have this personality behind the whole thing who has been giving the vision all along, and people have been buying in, literally, into the vision. Buying into. Or if you look at churches, established religious systems, they're buying into a vision of a literature, but it's usually with a literature with a certain personalities or prophets interpretation. You may have some kind of reformer, or you may have some kind of personality who sees the literature in a different way than everybody else and speaks about that vision, and others follow. Or others agree with that vision. And you will also see in due course of time that other personalities following in those footsteps may modify the vision even more to bring in other aspects which they're interested in. For example, economic aspects. Now, let's take a family, for instance. A family starts off with the vision of the mother and father. And even if they agree, that's rare. When you go to school, your educational system is set up by the boards of education. Governments are set up under the constitution of the country, which were created by people who had a certain vision. Every single group of people, regardless of its spiritual position, economic position, educational position, personal position, has somebody who's giving some guidance. You can't avoid it. You cannot avoid having the situation where a personality has to give input. And this is, as far as I can understand, more than anything else, a proof that this whole creation has a personality behind it who's giving that vision. Even if that vision is to let us find our own vision, that's still a vision. So this idea of giving, okay, that sounds very, in one sense, patriarchal. I give to you. But there's another way to look at it. That other way to look at it is like, okay, I see what you are, I see what you want, I see what you need, I facilitate you. That's my vision. And we understand from that, that it's very possible that somebody can give a vision which is a facilitating vision. In other words, one that does not demand compliance with their ideas, but which asks for agreement in this facilitation. You can't avoid there's a person involved in vision, but you can avoid that person interfering with the cooperative effort of that vision. So I hope that discussion kind of answered the question. But I'd like to give just one last comment to that, is that any vision needs to have the parameters of it set out for the people who are assisting or who are cooperating in developing that vision. Because you've got to know the limits of your vision. You have to know the limits or the elements within which your vision, which have to be accommodated by your vision.
Okay, she had a question that there are a different vision about the purpose of coming people to this world. I mean, she means that it's the particular question about these points, that there are two conflicted visions, that the religious organizations or sects or anyway how they call, I don't know, they have the vision that the people coming here to be punished because of their karma, and the world itself is a bad thing. It should be avoided. It is like a punishment place. And there are another vision that we are now sharing, and we are, personally me, accepting it much, much more than anything else, that the world is the place to develop. And what is the, she is asking, for me it is not a question, but she is asking that how to find what is the real vision, which is much more close to the reality. Since she said that there are different visions, for example, communists have the visions and Hitler have the vision, which was not close to the reality. It was illusory vision. And how to find the real vision? And exactly what can you say about the vision of to be punished here and to develop here?
I would say, me personally, that it's our choice whether or not we accept to believe this world is a bad place and we just have to avoid it, or this world is something we can work with and that it's all right if we did that. It's our choice to believe or not believe these things. Nobody's forcing us. And because it's our choice, the question of what is the right vision, because that was really one of the most essential questions which were asked there, the right vision. Which is the correct vision? Or put in another way, how can I find out what's the correct or right vision, is a moot point. After all, what's right, this word right with a capital letters, you know, right, what's right? It's what I make right. Even if there is, theoretically, an absolute right vision created by God and everyone has to follow that, if I don't believe it and I accept it, it's not my vision. Now, think about that point. Even if there is a completely absolute now, I don't believe that. But even if we think there's a perfect vision out there, and we just have to find it. But if I don't accept it, it is not the vision for me. Don't forget, vision means it's that which I accept. It's that which I am part of. So instead of asking what is the right vision, you should ask what is my vision. And if you don't like your vision, then change it. But don't go around trying to find the right vision and then kid yourself that you're going to embrace it fully. Because it's not your vision unless you accept it, unless it's your vision. Now, I realize that sounded very funny, because if you accept somebody else's vision, then you can say it's your vision. But I'm questioning this word, accept. If you accept it because you think it's right and therefore you should, it's quite different than if you accept it and you embrace it as your own. The quality of these two forms are very different. Now, I have another question here which is very interesting, because it says, it's very related. What are the main obstacles in developing a personal vision? Now, let's think about it in terms of this last question. If I think there is a right absolute vision out there, and my only goal in life is to just find it, that's a totally different task than developing a personal vision. Now, obviously, there is a reality, or not reality, but there is a power, there is an arrangement that's greater than us. We are part with it. We live within it, obviously. And like Kamala Mullis said, if we're left all on our own to find out a vision, well, if we don't have knowledge, the vision we develop isn't going to be very interesting. The point is that if you're left alone to find your own vision, you're going to find something on your level. It's not really going to be that much greater than you. Therefore, people are always seeking out information, seeking out knowledge, seeking out experiences to expand their point of view and thus expand their vision. And that is what it means to continually seek out the greatest, next greatest version of yourself in the grandest vision of yourself you've ever had. These two things are related. Whatever that greatest vision of yourself you've ever had, that can be modified. You can have a greater vision. But whatever that greatest vision is, and it doesn't matter where it appeared in time, go for it. And when you're going for it, try to be the next greatest version. In other words, try to have it as an advancement. Not that you'll necessarily ever reach your vision, or that your expansion of your vision will ever change, but you can just be the next greatest version. You can be one step, or whatever, greater. So what would develop, what would prevent us from developing this? I would say, number one, that we don't believe that we have the capacity. We don't believe that we have the power. We don't have faith in ourselves that we are moving forward. We think of ourselves as so lowly or so fallen or so incapable that we have to surrender the development of our vision to somebody else because their vision of us is better than our own. So I would say these particular issues are the major issues which prevent us from allowing ourselves to develop our spiritual vision. And when I say our spiritual vision, I don't have to say our personal spiritual division. This is a redundancy, because there is only one vision we can have, our own personal spiritual vision. Now, this is another question related to this very much, and I really like that we're getting deep into this point, because I think it's a great point. For us, we have a question here. To have a common vision, now we're speaking about a group of people, is it required that everybody share the same point of view, or that they simply trust each other and accept the different points of view? In other words, can vision be a multidimensional experience, or must it be a linear experience? Well, I'll go back to that answer I gave before about the arrangement of the Supreme or the arrangement of a spiritual facility. If the vision is to facilitate everybody's growth, and everybody's growing in different ways, that would certainly be multidimensional. So the common vision would be to accept other people as different, to respect them and appreciate them, and to be a facilitator for them when it's required. And that seems to be a very spiritual vision, to accommodate. It seems that all spiritual visions accommodate. And those visions which restrict are not necessarily very spiritual about. Of course, one would like to have a vision in which people are not harmed, people or animals even are not killed, or there is peace. And to a certain extent, these principles restrict morally or ethically. But these kind of principles are not restricting your freedom. They're just restricting you from harming others' freedom. That's, of course, the whole basis upon which legal systems, law, is created, justice is meted out. There is an interesting question I have here, which is not, of course, directly related, but which somehow or another is related, and I want to bring it up right now. I think it's a really fun question. That's why I want to bring it up. The essence of this question is that this person is working very hard to accept somebody with gratitude, to accept them and see them somehow so that they will accept them in this way. It's a very interesting point because many people feel like that, just to learn how to accept others. But the problem, according to this person, is when they do accept in that way, they lose that person. I think this is a fun question from two points of view at least. Just think about it from certain person's point of view, from the other side. Here you've got a person who really wants your approval, really needs that you accept them and are grateful to them. But when they get it, they don't need it anymore. They have accomplished their goal. And then they say, thank you, see you. And you go, wait a minute, I spent so much time just, you know, accepting you, and now you've gone away, I get nothing out of it. But wait, you've seen it in the wrong way. Your vision of the thing was that you're going to accept this person with great struggle, and when you do, you're then going to get something from this person, or you're going to have some kind of relationship or have some kind of control. But the other person's vision was quite different. The other person's vision was, I'm going to get you to understand how great I really am, and I'm going to feel really good about that. So you didn't share the same space in your activity. I mean psycho-emotional space. What is the solution? It's for you to change your understanding of the situation and learn to facilitate people's needs according to their needs. That's what means to be of service. And here, in this situation, we see very clearly the beauty of the spiritual principles of detachment, the beauty of the spiritual principle of not claiming proprietorship over the fruits of your labor. The Supreme and all the representatives in the universe have facilitated you. And in their facilitation of you, they have gifted you various elements, and you may do the same in turn. It's that flow that keeps things moving. It's that flow that gives life. And when you try to grab it to yourself and possess it and keep it and expect something from it, that's when the whole flow breaks down. Now, I think that answers that question, so I'm going to move on, but there's a lot more could be said about that. In fact, a whole lecture, and I think I have already. Now, I have a lot of other questions here. Not questions, some of them comments, and I think they're all great because they all are starting to point in another direction. And I'd like to start discussing that because I think it's just a fascinating issue we have touched upon. Let's think about it in another way. Let's think about it as very evolved beings. Let's think about it as a very evolved race. Now, Shivaratri brings up a nice point, because he's a musician, right? We musicians, we think in terms of tuning, we think in terms of notes. We think in terms of rhythms, we think in terms of syncopation. We think in terms of harmony. We even use dissonance to our advantage. Every musician who has ever jammed or done something live or spontaneous knows that sometimes the best stuff has happened because of a mistake. Sometimes you're playing and then you've got this thing going on, this kind of rhythm thing going on, and all of a sudden you're just zooming off the notes and you just make a little mistake and it changes the rhythm a little bit and people pick up on it and start doing that whole mistake as a thing. And the audience is like, wow, what just happened? And the musicians are like giggling because they know how it happened. It was just a mistake and we just played the mistake. But there are certain general principles that work here. Like, for example, you got to play in the same key. And all your instruments have to be in the same tonality. I suppose you know that until maybe, 300 years ago or 250 years ago or I don't remember, 200 years ago, until Bach created the well-tempered clavichord, musicians couldn't play with each other because all of the different instruments had different tunings. They couldn't fit together. They didn't agree on the frequencies. The frequencies didn't fit together, even though the notes may have been the same. So what he did, which was mathematical genius, by the way, and for this he should be remembered for all time, but most people have forgotten, he created a sympathetic formula within which all instruments can be tuned. He allowed all instruments to fit within the same frequency range that we now call music. And within that, because we all accept it, we can then accept to play in the same key with the same rhythm. Now, this is like an essential ingredient, that there's a harmonic ambience, a harmonic environment in which we play together. That's why there used to be countries with cultures, because it kept everybody within the same framework. And one of the major problems in places like in India or in China or in Asia or in the Islamic countries is this globalization where everything is becoming like this merge of pseudo-American so-called culture. And the natural differences between people, the natural qualities and characteristics of people in different parts of the world are being mixed with this, like, expectation to be in a global community acting the same way. So the orchestra is being modified by powerful personalities, powerful forces, so that the tuning comes to the well-tempered global clavichord. Because we had all these countries who were in different tunings and they couldn't play together so well. So people think, who do these things, that if we create a well-tempered clavichord of all countries in the world, it'll make a kind of like orchestrated harmony within which we can work. So instead of the Chinese being this way, the Indians being that way, the Americans being this way, the English being this way, and the French being this way, you have everybody kind of like in the same global orchestration. Now, whether or not that will work remains to be seen. But this idea of this kind of like a something that we agree upon, something that we agree to play within, is a really important point. But then again, Kamala Mal is asking me, well, what about like monarchy versus democracy? It seems that democracy is better because monarchy means dictation. Democracy means you work it out. Now, naturally, monarchy as we've ever known it in our histories or any histories we've read about is not very useful because of that very point. Vedic literature speak about monarchy in terms of, good kings like Maharaj Yudhisthira and so on who did things in such a way that it accommodated everybody. But to say that because these people were good monarchs and when they were good monarchs, everything was better, it doesn't follow that now we should have monarchy and we'll get back to that state. Without Maharaj Yudhisthira, without Maharaj Pariksit and so on, it's a useless system for today. Now, Shivaratri brings up another musical example, the conductor of an orchestra. The conductor is not a dictator. The conductor is somebody who helps everyone do everything at the same time, which is in all of their interests. If the third string on the second violin in the fourth seat over is out of tune, it's in everybody's interest that the conductor goes tap, 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 you, tune your violin. Now, most people don't really know what conductors do, so I think I'll just tell you a little bit more. Some people think that when there's music written in a score, right, like from Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, whatever, it's simple. Everybody plays it the same. It's the same notes, right? Wrong. Because notes are never perfect representations of the music. You can make very slight rhythmic differences that cannot be notated on paper. Very slight raising of volume, or crescendos, or diminuendos, or whatever. Picking up the pace just a little bit there, and just holding back just a little bit and going ahead. This is called the interpretation of the music. And it's the conductor's business to have the vision on the interpretation of the music. That's why some conductors make $10 million a year and others barely make $30,000 a year. Because the good ones can turn any piece of music with a good audience into something exquisite, something that grabs your mind and grabs your heart. And the musicians are honored to be in that orchestra. For the musicians to be in that orchestra is the fulfillment of their career. Because that conductor knows how to get everybody working together into such a tight group that they're just feeling each other. And when everybody feels each other and they're working towards the same goal and it's just fabulous result, they love it. So Maha is saying, do you think because of this, we move away from leader-driven associations to more intuitively driven associations where we trust each other as persons? And we all become like leaders from our own point of view, where we intuitively understand the multiple dimensionality, multi-dimensionality of the reality and visions of others and tune and align ourselves perfectly? Oh, I agree with that completely, but I don't think that's the sum total of it all. Back to the orchestra. Those professionals in that first-class orchestra are exactly like this comment by Maha. They are intuitive. They feel every musician in the orchestra. They've got a deep, deep connection. But, without that conductor, they are nothing. So I see the perfection of all this is having the conductor with the perfect synergistic group of incredibly intuitive and professional musicians. That's my vision. Actually, I wrote this very vision as the foreword to some Vyas Puja book. I think it was in 81 or 82 or something like that. And very few people understood what I was talking about. It was that very same example of a conductor in an orchestra, where you have all these incredibly qualified musicians who are following that lead, yet in and of themselves are incredibly qualified in their own way. See it as diamonds set in a beautiful crown. Each diamond is perfect. Each diamond is brilliant. Yet the crown as a whole is magnificent. In this way, when we have this vision to be an incredible crowning achievement of whatever it is we wish, yet we ourselves are all these diamonds in that crown, that is, in my vision, perfection. And then you've got the thing, how this orchestra integrates with another orchestra, how different orchestras integrate together. It's kind of like how universes integrate together or solar systems integrate together within the universe. Well, that's over my head, but it's an interesting thing to talk about.